Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
You know, people often ask me, Owen, they say, what is it like trying to remain impartial while analysing the phenomenal job your close personal friend David Moyes is doing in his second stint as West Ham manager? After all, they say, the former Manchester United manager and Everton bosses just vanquished Leicester City and is now on the verge of not only qualifying the Irons for the Champions League football for the first time in their history, but maybe equaling the club's best ever top flight finish. And I say, thank you for the question. Not sure why you're speaking like you're reading out a radio sports bulletin, but thank you for the question nonetheless. And the answer is simple, my friend. I say, it's not that difficult to be impartial when I'm just saying what everyone else is thinking. This guy is working miracles and surely is on his way to Manager of the Year honours. Welcome to Monday Set Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you? And well done.
Thank you. Well done indeed.
Well done, Owen. Well done.
I know
congrats,
you might, listen, I know you might look at the table and say, hang on a minute. They've got Chelsea and Liverpool breathing down their necks, but you're forgetting one very important point here.
That's what I do. I win.
Exactly. 16 times already this season. Okay, granted, they caught a break yesterday with Leicester missing a bunch of their best players for breaking COVID regulations. But again, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are.
That's what I do. I win.
Agreed. That's what he does. He wins. What's West Ham's highest ever finish in the Premier League or old First Division, do you reckon, guys?
Fourth.
Third place in 1986.
Yeah, third place, 85-86, which is where they could soon sit after beating. I mean, they're still fourth, but just 1 point behind.
Well, they're playing Chelsea next, aren't they?
Exactly.
Chelsea looked pretty tasty the other day, though, Owen. Did you not think?
Chelsea looked tasty.
What about the week before, Ken?
Owen, did you see?
Taken down by Britain's other great manager of.
They didn't look so good the week before, I'll give you that. Although they did have an unfortunate first half red card. When you're playing a numbers game like Tuchel, it does the house of cards. You do need all the cards to be on the table. I mean, but did you see Kai Havertz, like, not just his goal, but his Pele flick over the head of a defender, which resulted in a near miss? I saw that and I thought to myself, God, what I immediately thought of was Harry Redknapp going, did he bring the Germans in? And I thought the great thing about that interview that Harry Redknapp gave is that Frank Lampard now can't even retrospectively claim credit for having signed that guy. You know what I mean? He's cut off even from the aura of the reflected glory that's going to come to people.
He planted a tree that he knew he would never sit under.
No, he didn't plant the tree. He objected to the tree. And now it towers.
He
went
all the way to the council to object to the planting of this tree. Nevertheless, here we are.
That's good that we've got all the facts out there.
Well, as Adam pointed out to me, Christ, if West Ham can hold off Chelsea, then the rest of the run-in is very welcoming. Chelsea have City, Arsenal, Leicester and Villa. I don't actually have the West Ham fixtures in front of me here. Adam!
I was looking at the West Ham fixtures and Chelsea is definitely, the toughest one. Yeah. I think they've got Everton in there. But it does look sort of... Do West Ham have games against the soft centre of the table? You know what I mean? Or nothing to maybe, hang on, who have they got? They've got Burnley. That's a tough one. Newcastle. Okay, these are struggling teams. Now it's Newcastle next, Chelsea, Burnley, Everton, Brighton, West Brom. Actually, they're playing mainly relegation threatened teams.
Yeah,
they're playing all the relegation teams.
Yeah,
they're down there for a reason.
Relegation is going to be done and dusted. But I mean, relegation is essentially. Did you not see Newcastle again at the weekend? They're okay now. I mean, Burnley aren't going to get relegated. Come on, they're 33 points. So I think it's okay. I also think it might be something of a myth that you don't want to be playing. There is a reason these teams are down near the bottom of the table, and that is that they're easy pickings for the.
Well, all I'm saying, you can ask Thomas Tuchel what he thinks of West Brom and CR7. You know what I mean? You can't necessarily
look. Listen, those teams know they have to look elsewhere for points. West Ham are just unstoppable at the moment. There's just no stopping them. What's the point? I mean, they'll play a shadow team. They'll rest up. They'll get recovered. They'll plow, and when they meet someone that they think they can take a point off of, they'll field their full strength team. I mean, that's just smart management at this stage of the season.
And they're doing it all without Declan Rice as well. I mean, he's out for weeks now, isn't he? I mean, he's at the point where it's maybe doubtful whether he's going to make the Euros. Not necessarily because he's injured, not because the injury itself rules him out, but because. Maybe he won't have played enough before. No, he'll probably go anyway, won't he?
Yeah. I mean, he was trying to engineer a move to the German national team last week.
Declan
Rice.
That
tweet about Tony Kroos.
Tony Kroos responding, thanks, mate.
Yeah, he's. Declan Rice is going nowhere.
The young fella makes me so angry.
Sure, it would be a dream to one day play for the German. But for now.
they have no Declan Rice, but they had Mark Noble pulling the strings for the 400th time. I mean, what a story that is in its own right. Great things happening at my beloved Irons right now. Yeah. It's hard to keep track. We've got Champions League second legs tomorrow and Wednesday night. The competition, of course, at West Ham will be in next season. So there'll be loads of coverage coming up during the week for World Service members. Tomorrow we're also going to celebrate Rachel Blackmore making history in the Grand National. And speaking of celebrations...
Better, LeVar or Michael Jordan?
Ain't nobody think about no damn LeVar.
Yes, they are.
Owen McDevitt from Ireland's Second Captain Show.
Owen McDevitt, you're a cold piece of work.
You're looking good. I know you're feeling good.
Owen, you're amazing.
I'm like, yeah.
2,000 podcast recordings today and the Second Captain Show in Ireland. Owen McDevitt.
Owen, I like you and I like your style.
Yeah. I hear you in your 40s and you're bald headed. Let's just put it this way. You ahead of Owen McDevitt.
Hey, Jack Charlton, we're just about out of time. Been a pleasure talking to you.
I can't believe it, dog. I know what 2000 is. And that's a heck of a feat. But any man, I love your style.
It's delicious.
I'm Owen McDevitt.
Owen McDevitt.
He's a non-event as far as I'm concerned.
You're bald-headed.
Hang on, that took a bit of a turn near the end. It was somewhat flattering. And then all I'm getting, I'm a bald-headed non-event.
Happy birthday, though.
Happy birthday, Owen.
Owen.
That's not why I was playing that bed. I was playing it to promote our 2000 episodes celebration.
We all know the real celebration.
41 in lockdown, second birthday in lockdown. It's not really, I'm not feeling it today. I got to be honest. It's a bit, I'm feeling a bit subdued.
So you have averaged about one episode of Second Captains per week for your entire life. That's basically that's what you've achieved.
That's the average I'm up to
it's
now.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Thanks to
listen to them all.
Thanks to Danny G for the music suggestion there of the Koreatown Oddity. That tune actually features a reference to the great LeVar Ball himself, believe it or not. If any of you have any music suggestions, by the way, for Audio Beds, do get in touch with us. The 2000 podcast celebrations are dominating the World Service at the moment. What about that interview on Friday between Doddles and Paul Kimmage? It was unbelievable.
It's very good.
Yeah, you enjoyed it?
Really enjoyed that one. I loved it.
If you haven't heard it yet, it's a really lovely, personal, very funny interview where David and Paul tried to come to terms with their love-hate relationship with cycling. Although it's not only cycling. I mean, there's also some of this stuff.
Those Liverpool players could run onto the pitch with the fucking steroids in their arms, being taped to their fucking arms, and the fans wouldn't give a shite. They would not give a shite. And that's the bottom line. The fans don't give a shite.
Yeah, I mean, what Paul Kimmage is saying there is, sure, I'll spend an hour and a half with David O'Doherty raking over the pain of the drugs issues in cycling, but, you know, do fans of other sports care whether or not there's any issues in their sports? That was one of the...
He said his piece there, Owen.
He said his piece. I don't really need to... Yeah, I think Paul's words speak for themselves there. But it got a huge reaction from our members, so you can sign up if you want to listen. I should say, Paul Kimmich wasn't talking about a specific issue at the great esteemed Liverpool Football Club there. You know, that was just an example of a team and a rabid fan base who hypothetically wouldn't give a shit, in his words, whether or not the players were up to something. Coming this week is the glorious return of one of our original contributors from back in the day.
We went to Port Marnock and I bought 22 choc ices.
It's our Roddy Collins reunion show. What did Roddy think of Ken Snubb in the Phoenix Park? How many of his enemies can Roddy call out in one interview?
Quite a few, it turns out.
Is Ken now one of Roddy's enemies himself? Find out all of this on Wednesday's show as Roddy tells us about the game that changed his life, and hopefully we get more sound bites like this one.
Lord, they're up there on a Cowtown beach.
Yeah, Roddy is back to put us all in good form this Wednesday. You were on the phone to him, Murphy. Put you in good form.
He did.
Fan, so he's going to cast his spell on the World's Smallest Membership.
You know he will, Owen. He never disappoints in that area.
We only reached the 2,000 milestone because of the support of our amazing members. So if you'd like to join them and you can afford the fiver a month plus VAT, please pop on to secondcaptains.com and have a look at what's on offer. Now, report on the sport, please, Ken.
It's interesting, isn't it, what Kimmich was saying there? I mean, I think it's true that fans of football generally wouldn't care. You know, in the sense that, like, I mean, I should specify about their own teams. Obviously, they would care. They would all point the finger at each other. So maybe that's the sort of, you know, everyone will police everyone else's drug cheating or whatever.
When you think about some of the things that get mentioned in, you know, the football discourse online, you know, and it's not to say that it's as direct an impact as, you know, steroid use in football. You'd have to say that there's a lot of people just ready and willing to start making extraordinary straw man arguments to explain away why it's actually not that big a deal why my team are taking steroids.
Yeah, but I do think it's interesting. I mean, because he's talking about football fans, but are cycling fans different? And is that something to do with the nature of the sport? I mean, cycling is basically an individual sport, even though it's a team sport, right? And are you really? Is it a sport where you support a team? Not really. Like, I mean, no one was supporting U.S. Postal when Lance Armstrong. You know what I mean? Like, it's the teams are kind of like these nebulous entities that nobody cares about. I mean, am I wrong about that? Are there people who support cycling teams?
Oh, you're asking the wrong man here. But I don't think so. I mean, no one talks.
You follow riders.
Way, yeah.
Team Sky certainly had a certain aura around them for a
while. Did they? Well, maybe they did because they were, in a way, what they were, though, was kind of the English national cycling team, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know not everyone cycling with Team Sky had to be English, but they were like Team England, really, were they not? Like, in terms of their... what they represented in the world of professional cycling.
Yeah, it was like Team GB in professional cycling.
So I wonder
to the utterly uneducated eye.
If it is the kind of sport where you support a team, are you more likely to be like, yeah, anything goes? Like, you know, are cycling fans more likely to be like, to be actually upset by this than football fans would be, for instance?
Not necessarily. I don't know if the point is that cycling fans are more... I think the point is that sports fans in general have tended to use cycling and track and field as the piñatas. You know, they're the sports with the problems. Mm. So, and because they have had serious problems over the years.
They are.
and because it's always had the classic thing where, well, that's the clearest one because whatever about skill level, etc. Like, those are the ones where you can see the clearest gains from performance-enhancing drugs. You know, back in the day when you would hear the argument of...
haven't seen a PED... improve your first touch.
Yeah, which
as
is
Mark
ludicrous,
Lawrence
obviously.
Or someone would say.
Yeah, which is obviously ludicrous because we all know PEDs do improve your first touch. No, we all know about the physical, you know, the physical benefits that help your football game or whatever it is. So I think the point that Kimmich was making was like, yeah, okay, let's beat up cycling here, which I've been doing for 30 years on and off, but let's also beat up other sports, and fans of other sports seem to be fine with thinking it's either... Now, he didn't mention Russia, but I could throw Russia into this as well. There's always another bogeyman. It's Russia, or it's cycling, or it's track and field, or it's whatever, East Germany back in the day. But people are less inclined to want to believe that it could possibly be the sport that they love and that they care about and that there's a big part of their identity.
Mm. Mm.
Your point is also possible. Is also partly valid. Yeah, I mean the tribalism, I don't think exists to that extent. Maybe the tribalism is a little bit different in that, you know, France.
It's bound up in nationalism as opposed.
Nationalism, certainly. Like Lance Armstrong was an American coming over, and you know he would have thought that the French were bitter, you know, that he was winning their race and these kind of things. But it's a complicated and nuanced area indeed.
Look, all I'm saying was it's bloody good.
Bloody good
listen.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it. Where were we? Oh yes, I suppose we should start with the match at Old Trafford. I mean, there's a huge amount to say about this.
Old Trafford.
I should say the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, of course. We've already had the match at Old Trafford between these teams. This was the return fixture. Manchester United giving Tottenham a bloody good game. As Scott McTominay said, we talked about it a lot. We knew we had to give these a game, and how. Manchester United, who, of course, the bureaucrats tried to cheat them, of the victory with this VAR intervention. I mean, it was a big week for Ole. What was it a big week for? It was a big week for
game is gone. Game is absolutely gone.
It was a massive, one of the biggest weeks yet for the game's gone. I mean, at least cycling, they still have a sport. You know, as in football, you know, there's just nothing left. But I mean, it was a huge week of just terrible, like appalling, absurd VAR decisions. Just butchering games. Just you're just like, oh God, oh please. Please make it stop. One exception to this, I should say, is the UK opposition leader, Keir Starmer. What do you think of VAR, Keir?
Oh, I quite like VAR. You know, this is the lawyer of me. I quite like the right decision. Although, you know, as ever, it depends who's playing.
Richard Nixon in The Simpsons there just comes to mind. I do would like to state my preference for that particular beer.
I also like them. No, he's well, apparently Keir Starmer is actually
he's thrown against the tide. No, it's fair, but just there was something about the delivery there that made me think that maybe Keir doesn't really give that much of a shit about this
I think maybe because Keir Starmer is more of a football player than necessarily a fan, you know. I believe he's actually a very good football player.
I saw photographs of him recently.
Oh, he was, well, he, people were mocking him. I mean, okay, look, I'm sure he's past his best as a footballer at this stage. Like, you know, there isn't a 50-year-old man alive who doesn't look ridiculous trying to play football now, you know? Maybe there are a few 50-year-olds, but most 50-year-olds. What age is Keir Starmer? why am I talking so
it doesn't
much
matter.
About him?
It's fine. Yeah. We get the picture. He's a middle-aged man.
Apparently he's a football man, but on VAR, I think he's wrong.
58.
Is
he?
Whoa.
Wow.
Okay, well, he's older. He
looks he's older tremendous. Than Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson.
Fair play to him.
Yeah.
God, he really does look very well.
But where were we? Okay, so why is it so awful? Here's the unique dimension of awfulness. One of them that was, I think, highlighted by some of the decisions this weekend in particular. And this is something that, you know, people will say, oh, well, it's not VAR, it's the rules. You know, people will tweet you this all the time. Oh, it's not VAR. No, it's VAR. And here's the difference, that you never used to have this thing that now happens quite a lot, of a goal being scored and then being ruled out for something that happened way back in the move, which is actually irrelevant, but perhaps arguably technically illegal. Yeah. It's irrelevant, but arguably technically illegal. Now, the whole category of irrelevant but illegal is actually an important one in football, and it's shrunk away. VAR has taken this very vital category, which lubricated the game, away from us. And so what we had here was just to take that Man United goal. This is the goal. First of all, can I ask you both, what is your opinion of it?
Not a foul.
You don't think it was a foul? Do you think it was a foul, Owen?
I'm a little bit where I am with the Bellingham one last week.
Just call it on. Come on, will you? Stop sitting on the fence.
Call it.
Yeah, it's
on.
A foul.
We're two Anton Chiggers here.
It's a foul.
You think it's a foul? Okay. Well, I can see why you might think that, right? Because you haven't spent very long looking at it. You don't really know what's going on, and you think you're one of those people who thinks hand to face, you can't do that. But here's the point. Why, you know, you can't hit somebody in the face. You're not, you know, hand to face, whatever. You're not supposed to hit someone. The people say hand to face because if somebody like kind of goes to hit someone and doesn't hit them very hard, that's still like still not allowed, right? But there has to be a distinction between if somebody like hand to face in this instance, what's McTominay done? He's literally tried to push Son's arm away. Son's putting his arm out, and McTominay put his arm out, and they're going to try and use their arms against each other. This is something you're allowed to do. Look at what Paul Pogba does on the third Manchester United goal. The way that he just uses his arm and his body to sort of, it's Eric Dier, I think, just sort of shrug Eric Dier aside to so that he can then play that ball out to Greenwood. You know, this is like, this is just what you do in football. This is how you play football. I mean, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer actually demonstrated how to run, although it looked more like he was doing doggy paddle when he did the demonstration of how to run. But the point was that you use your arms. He puts his arms out to Son's arm, and then you can see that the arms come together, and McTominay's hand catches on Son's thumb, and then a little bit of force builds up, and then it comes off the thumb. It's sort of like a sort of a catapulting action, flicks into Son's face. It's a genuine contact. Son goes down. He's not simulating because he has just been kind of flicked in the face by the fingers, which, you know, is painful enough. But it's not a foul. It's like an irrelevant and accidental event. It's just like, yeah, I mean, shit happens on the pitch. That's not a foul. The play goes on. Pogba does a bit of pausa. You know, Pep would have liked that. A bit of pausa by Pogba through the legs. Cavani then through the keeper's legs. Brilliant goal. Then it's like, oh no, there's a hand to face. Let's go back and back and back and back. Let's wind this one all the way back. Oh, it's a hand to face and rule it out on a technicality. This is absurd. And it is VAR. The reason the referee's thinking, oh, well, he's got his hand to face there. I don't think it's that bad. Like, he didn't think it was bad because he didn't send McTominay off.
Yeah, that's
they
it.
They even like, said it's accidental.
Literally the exact point I was going to make. I mean, if it's hand to face, then there's a punishment.
It's
for
a
that.
Yellow
then,
card.
And he's already got a yellow card, so it's a red card. So this, like, the idea is, like, I've looked at it now. Everyone has seen me look at it. Everyone has seen me see this minuscule contact with the face of Son. Therefore, I have to disallow the goal. But I know that it's kind of farcical, so I'm not going to send the lad off because that's heaping farce upon farce. It's still not a foul. Can't be a foul because if it is a foul, it's a non-contact sport.
Yeah, it's not a foul, and it's a terrible decision. It's created by the fact that the referee's confronted with this video of this irrelevant event, and then forced to rule on it, and then he then compounds it by making a bad decision. But look, I mean, then that led to this whole argument between the managers afterwards, and actually, I don't even want to play the. Actually, no, we will play the Ollie audio because it's just like, what is this? Here's Solskjaer like trying to say what he thinks about it.
I said we shouldn't be conned, but I have to say, if my son stays down like this for 3 minutes and he gets 10 of his mates around him, if he gets that in the face from one of his other mates and he needs 10 mates to help him up, yeah. He won't get any food, and I'm still saying that. I'm saying the same now as I did with the first time we played him.
Okay, like I mean, I don't know why he keeps doing this. Like, what he did this after the last game. Like, my son would live on bread and water for 2 weeks if he did. Just, that was what he said after the last Tottenham Man United game when it was it Lamella who was involved in the thing with Martial. Remember Martial got sent off in the 6-1 game, mm-hmm. And he's just sort of like. Okay, I don't really know why he keeps arriving at that. Is that what he started out intending to say? I'm not sure.
I mean, this time at least he didn't, because 2 weeks does seem a bit extreme. I mean, that's
right, well, at least he was giving him bread and water. Whereas in this case, he just wasn't going to give him any food.
But for several days. Well, I suppose for an indeterminate period of time, I can only think he would have at some point. At least sort of stepped it up to the bread and water, and then maybe given him full breakfasts. And
well,
just...
this was just very strange. But then it prompted an even stranger reaction from Mourinho. From Mourinho, it's like, well, this isn't. I might as well play Mourinho here. This is so ridiculous that I feel like I'm wasting your time by playing it. But just in case you haven't heard it, here it is.
Sonny is very lucky that his father is a better person than Ole, because I think a father. I am a father. I think a father, you have always to feed your kids. Doesn't matter what they do. If you have to steal to feed your kids, you steal. I'm very, very disappointed. And because with me, like we say in Portugal, bread is bread and cheese is cheese, I told already Oli what I think about his comments. And I have to tell you that I'm very, very disappointed that in 5, 6, 7 questions, you ignore the dimension of that comment.
Like, that is just nonsense. You know, you have to feed it. What does bread is bread and cheese is cheese mean, by the way? What does that actually mean?
I don't know. I mean,
bread is bread and cheese is cheese. I mean, okay, yeah, I agree, but like, what's the...
I would have thought bread is bread, and then, you know, a high more highfalutin food group would be the next to, you know, would be the next words out of your mouth. You know, to, as if to emphasize the bread is bread, that's fine, you need to eat that. But then there's also food for enjoyment and love, and do you know what I mean? I just don't get the reference. But
no,
then again,
I don't,
you know,
I don't understand. But the person at the center of all this was San himself, who gave a very sad interview. Let's just play the first answer that he gave. This is San quivering with emotion, speaking to like Spurs TV or, you know, the Tottenham in-house channel after the game.
Yeah, I think I'm really disappointed this afternoon. I really don't know what to say. I'm really sorry about it and feel bad. And who's been always passionate from outside, from this stadium, who's supporting us. I know he's really, really disappointed. I think they are more disappointed than us. So I feel really bad and really, really sorry about it. So it's a really sad afternoon.
That's well, so San there being appropriately displaying appropriate emotions. I think that would you'd have to, you know what that reminded me of? It was a time when we had a road show years and years ago down in Cork or somewhere, and Ronan O'Gara was the guest. I don't know if you remember this, but
that was Cork, yeah,
it was Cork. And Ronan
it was
O'Gara,
called the Woolshed or something, wasn't it?
I can't remember the name of the place, but I remember Ronan O'Gara had come along. But the thing was that, like, just before, like, he'd obviously been booked to do it, like, I don't know, 10 days beforehand or something. You know, there was a plan for him. But then in the last couple of days before this show, like, was it a Monday show? Mm. So on the weekend, Munster had obviously lost whatever game they were playing. Whatever game they were playing. And then Ronan O'Gara came along. And obviously at this type of roadshow, you're hoping for the guests to be like, oh, you know, a bit of banter with the crowd and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like a bunch of boozed up people at a pub, and you hope they... But O'Gara, because they had lost, had to ostentatiously put on this display of total misery. Like, you know the way he can be a bit like... His voice is sort of naturally a bit monotonous, but he was just absolutely like sackcloth and ashes. Like, it was just like, oh, I really don't feel I can smile at anything after what happened over there. You're just like, oh,
quick,
come on. Like,
yeah. Quick, plan B, get Donal Lennon into his 1980s tight shorts and parade him around.
I should probably take this whoopee cushion off this chair then, Ronan. I apologise for any offence that that may have caused. I really can't express how sorry again I am.
Sonny knows he's being watched. You know, he wouldn't do to seem too casual. And I wouldn't take away from the fact that maybe he is a bit broken up about the Spurs look like they're going to miss out in the Champions League. Look, there's still a good few games to play. What else was going on? More of this VAR nonsense. I mean, the Mourinho referred to the one between Fulham and Wolves. I don't know anything anymore. I just don't know anything. I don't know anything about the modern world anymore, Mourinho was saying. But if you saw the decision, it's just so ridiculous. Again, a micro offside against Daniel Podence to rule out a Wolves goal. And there was another micro offside in the game at Anfield. And this was like the McTominay one the move went on and then it sort of went on. And there was even a touch on the ball from an Aston Villa player. But there was several more interventions from different players before it eventually goes to Firmino, who scored what seemed like an equalising goal for Liverpool. But then they spent the next 3.5 minutes looking for a reason to disallow this goal, which eventually they found by saying that Diogo Jota is offside, even though at the moment when they show this fractional, like, micro offside, you know, it's the lines and it's the arm. You can't actually see the ball. You can't see the ball in this frame. You know what I mean? You don't know that that's the moment the ball's being kicked. And yet they're presenting it as evidence that this goal, which again continued, the move continued from this moment, that this goal now has to be, we have no choice but to rule this out. Just total nonsense. Now, I mean, you see people say things like, well, you know, three and a half minutes, like everyone's just standing there waiting for them to, and why is it taking so long? Like, is it really that big a deal, this thing that they're, and eventually after 3.5 minutes, okay, they rule it out. And you see people say, well, you know, what they should do is have a system so that if you can't see it in the first 20 seconds or so, then you just give it. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, in other words, like it's a time limit. Before, you know, and if it looks offside, if it doesn't look offside enough in that time limit, then you just give the goal. In other words, right, what they're talking about is the old system. Like, basically, it's just, if it looks offside, then raise your flag. Like, that's the system we used to have, where the linesman is there and they're looking at it. And if, at first glance, which is the only glance you're going to get, this looks like an offside, then you raise your flag. And if not, then the play goes on.
Well, so, that gets rid of the egregious ones. You know, like the ones where, for whatever reason, the linesman has just had a mare and he's fellas two yards offside. That gets rid of the agree. Everything else after that then is, as you said, just a judgment call, what it used to be.
I don't know if there ever were that many egregious ones, though, really.
Yeah, like...
lines like
That's a point worth making, I think.
Yeah. But look, in the end, like Manchester United, Liverpool got away with it. Or won the game despite this having a goal ruled out. In my opinion, unfairly, thanks to none other than the reincarnation of Steven Gerrard, Trent Alexander-Arnold. And I have to say, you know, you saw Trent Alexander-Arnold going, celebrating that goal, and then posting afterwards, you know, are you not entertained? Who one wonders who that was directed to. And thinking, yeah, it probably feels a lot better doing that than being walked past repeatedly by Ferland Mendy in the Madrid game, or heading the ball to Sergio Asensio, and then being patronized by like every former defender pundit on television who's like advising you how you can, you know, some of them are just sort of giving you pep talks. Like Gary Neville's like, he needs to get serious. Or Rio Ferdinand's like, he needs to go back to basics. Right? Ashley Cole at least is giving like technical advice of a more specific technical advice. He needs to look at foot patterns. Basically, the way that he's standing when a player comes at him a certain way, when a player sort of addresses him with the ball in a particular position, what way are his feet? Because if they're not right, then it's a matter of whether you're quick, you will be beaten. Ashley Cole, at least, was kind of giving... Jamie Carragher as well, giving technical advice. Although I have to say that the technical coaching that Jamie Carragher was offering, and this was in his midweek Champions League slot, was in CBS, I think, seemed a little bit basic. Like, you know, in the sense of... He was saying... Did you see it?
No.
Yes.
He was demonstrating, you know, they've got that spacious studio. Like Michael Richards was actually somersaulting around in it at one point.
They have a hell of a time over there.
He was literally
judging by the highlights, but
literally cartwheeling around in this stadium amid riotous laughter from everybody. But a more serious bit featured Jamie Carragher demonstrating how to sort of jockey a guy who comes at you, and you've got to have your legs bent. And what Trent Alexander-Arnold doesn't do is bend his legs enough, so he can't apparently spring off. You know, this is why he gets beaten so easy. Anyway, just thinking, this is all a bit much, isn't it? Like, if you're Trent Alexander-Arnold, would you not have started to think, yeah, you know, I'm actually a bit tired of this. Like, what if I just did what I did in the last minute of the game against Aston Villa? What if that was my job instead of, like, worrying about foot patterns? Maybe that would be better for me and for this struggling football club whose system that I was a successful part of over the last couple of years no longer actually works.
So what you're saying, just give up on defending and be an attacking fullback?
No, I'm saying... Cast off the shackles of being a fullback and assume your true form, which is to be a great central midfielder. Turn from a caterpillar into a butterfly, Owen. That's what I'm saying. Spread your beautiful wings and flutter around in the attacking third. not worrying too much about what happens at the back. That is the responsibility of more junior teammates than yourself.
That'll work. I mean, that'll work. I could see him in there. But is it not just the case that they get Van Dijk back, they get some solidity back in the team, they get their system going again, and then he's going to look every bit as good as he has done for the last couple of seasons?
But is it good with England, though?
Is he looking good enough? That's what I have to say. Why couldn't he be looking better than Kevin De Bruyne? Instead of like, it's like having De Bruyne at right back. Why not be, I am now better than him as a midfielder?
He's still going to have John Stones and Harry Maguire beside him with England. He's still going to have to do a bit of defending on.
Yeah, okay. I'm convinced. Fine, centre mid.
I was kind of interested. The centre mid thing did come up in the Monday Night Football with Neville and Carragher last week in a kind of weird offhand way. That Jamie Carragher ended up saying you could play Trent, you know, in midfield, you know, which I think he could be an excellent central midfielder, obviously, but from the point of view of picking the squad for the Euros, Jamie Carragher was like, I'm going to pick a 23-man squad. I'm going to have 9 defenders, one of which is Trent Alexander-Arnold, and you can push him into midfield if you like. To which Gary Neville was like, well, why don't you just pick a midfielder there? Instead of saying, Trent, this is, you know, a career move that we can see for you. So why not make your debut in that position here at the Euros when we have like an absolute wealth of options to play in that particular position. I mean, it was a pretty bizarre moment from Carragher.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, to be honest, I was expecting more fireworks here. You know, I was expecting this, my controversial point, to really set the cat among the pigeons here, but it's been an absolute dead cat bounce here. The pigeons are pecking at the rotting cat.
He is, like, obviously an utterly brilliant footballer. I mean, I read your time piece in the Times today. Is there a body of work that suggests he can be brilliant in central midfield? I mean, he has all the ability in the world, obviously, to play as a midfielder. I don't think he's going to play as a six, but he would surely play on the right hand, on the left hand flank of a midfield three. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, look, who knows? You know, is there a place for him in the system that Liverpool play in midfield? Maybe not. I mean, is he the type of player that Jurgen Klopp would? Does he fit the profile of a Jurgen Klopp midfielder? Maybe not. You know, maybe Klopp likes players who are a little bit stronger than Trent is. Like, you know, he's obviously kind of a skinny build. Maybe Klopp likes guys who are more, I don't want to say more athletic, because I do think he is quite athletic, but more solid in those sorts of positions. I mean, it would be a problem for Liverpool, because it's like, how do you replace a right back of this quality? It's difficult to find one like that.
So Trent moved to Bayern Munich. They know what to do in this situation. That's what you're saying.
Well, they've converted
more fullbacks than you've had hot dinners, Ken.
They have, absolutely. You know, you did. I'm glad you read the article at least into the second half of it.
Ken, so, I read it all the way through, and I read parts of it twice because it was so good.
No, thanks. Look, listen, hopefully the next thing will be more exciting for Owen. Real Madrid on, up next, of course.
Impress me, it's my birthday.
I mean, I didn't say I wasn't excited. Maybe I'm just sitting here, second year of lockdown. People shouldn't be having second birthdays in lockdown, you know? I mean, It should have been one and done, right? We should
lying there in a big purple cushion, eating grapes, thumbs down. Next, okay, Owen, what have I got for you?
Ken, did I tell you what? My wife arrived in with a cake yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. And my reaction was, I was like, oh, I'm not eating that. And she's like, what? And I was like,
what a charmer.
Oh, I know.
I'm not eating shite. that's surely Valentine, Owen.
I was like, not eating that. She's like, what? And I was like, oh no, just I came in from a run earlier, and I had a packet of crisps, which is grand, because I was planning that, you know, I had it in my head, I'm gonna have a packet of crisps after this, right? And I'm not gonna feel bad. But then I also saw a leftover pan au chocolat, and I just ate that as well, and I got one of those moments, you know, you get where you go, I'm just not eating shite for a week. Unfortunately,
you literally said, I'm not eating shite
to myself,
Shirley Valentine's husband. Yeah, okay,
in my internal monologue. Then unfortunately, this is bad timing, because a short time later my wife arrives in, and I just happen to see the cake in her hand, and I go, I won't be having any of that. And she's like, it's your birthday cake. I'm actually telling
can
the story.
Can you believe this guy? Can you believe this guy, Ken?
No, I'm afraid. I'm sorry to say, I can't. I'm sorry to say, I can't believe
what?
This.
What? You think that's typical? Oh no, I was hoping this is atypical, that I would be I mean, I feel.
No, that's the thought went into your head. You said it. And then, only then on did
so
you
So that's rattling
that.
Around in my head. I mean, I did apologize. I did explain where my mindset was at. And, you know, but this is all, second birthday in lockdown. I'm not in the right mindset. 41's the one that gets you. I didn't know, but
41 is the one that'll really land.
I should be bouncing back off you on this midfield, Alexander Arnold midfield thing. Fine. I just kind of feel... I don't have the heart to argue with you today, Ken. So that's why I just said, you're right. Put him in midfield. Put him up front. Put him in goals.
Who cares? I'm eating cake for lunch.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to eat some cake.
You're almost spiritually broken enough to be a Barcelona player after Saturday night's El Clasico.
Unbelievable segue.
Great segue. That's obviously Madrid, but again in Champions League action. They beat Liverpool 3-1 last week, then they beat Barcelona 2-1, and the first goal in particular, an absolutely beautiful goal, featuring, dare I say it, on Barcelona style move from the back to the front, with a culminating in a near post cross and a little back heel finish by
Benzema.
And it really showed the thankless task of the fullback. You know, I'm sure Trent Alexander-Arnold was watching with interest what happened to Jordi Alba as he decided to run forward and try and challenge Federico Valverde, realized too late, oh no, I've got that run wrong, haven't I? And the ball is played in behind him to Lucas Vazquez, who crosses for Benzema, and that's a goal. Although Lucas Vazquez then went on to do a cruciate ligament. Now, it's kind of a sprain to his posterior cruciate ligament, is how Real Madrid describe it, which means he's out for the season pretty much, but I don't know whether it's like a full tear, a sprain. It's kind of an unusual way to say it, but obviously any injury to the cruciate ligament is not good. So he's going to be out, and the other player, Valverde, is also doubtful. Apparently that would be a big loss to Real Madrid because he's a lot of their energy in midfield. We'll see if he makes it. There was a lot of sass after the game, Owen.
Mm-hmm.
Modric said to Pique at the end, oh, now it's time for you to complain, yeah? It's a full time now, so now this is when you start to whinge, right? Pique's like, oh come on, man, you know they only gave 4 minutes of extra time, 4 minutes of injury time, and Modric's like, oh yeah, how much do you think they should have given? And it's like, why don't you get out of my face, Modric? You know?
I was watching; it was so funny. Pique was it was all over the referees. In fairness, they had a penalty that they probably should have had. Then they hit the crossbar near the end, which is obviously nothing to do with the referees. Ter Stegen had a shot, looked like he had a shot that hit off his own, but it was just this wild ending. And immediately Pique, I can't remember, did he start and come off or was he not playing at all? But anyway, he was in his big hoodie and he was haranguing the referees. So I'm not surprised that he got into it with one of the Real Madrid players as well. By the way, is Leo Messi going to play for the rest of the season? Because the fella had hypothermia by the looks of things.
Oh my god. I mean, he was changing his shirt
while
and everything.
While that VAR check was going on for the penalty, I think it was during that check, the camera, as always, picks out Leo Messi. Just what's Leo Messi doing now? He's standing there. He's facing his own bench as though he's having a conversation with them whether to come over or not. And you can physically see his face shaking, like his teeth chattering. And then eventually he decides after about a minute, okay, I'm going over, I'm going to bite the button, I'm going to do it. And he runs over because they have a spare jersey ready for him. Yeah. Starts getting into the spare jersey. And look, the same thing happens to Leo Messi as might happen to the rest of us if we're, for some reason, have to change playing five-a-side. The match just restarts and suddenly you're scrambling to put it on and you miss the set. You get back on there. But I don't know how long the second one stayed dry for because it was an awful looking night, but he was absolutely Baltic, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he eventually had no choice but to start running around to try and stay warm. He did. He also got disrespected by the referee who said to him, after listening to him whinging, Gil Manzano, the referee, apparently turned around and said, do you know the rules of football? Because if not, I can talk to you and explain them to you after the game. He said this apparently to Lionel Messi, which I guess Messi probably didn't find that funny at the time. But what's going on? I mean, we never even mentioned that Leeds beat City.
Of course.
I mean, the goal by Stuart Dallas is amazing. Like, to make a run like that in the last minute, 10 men.
Stuart Dallas, of course.
Cookstown, Stuart Dallas, of course, just up there near in the Maharafelt area.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the retail heart of Mid-Ulster. I don't need to tell you, Ken.
Absolutely.
There's a sign going into Cookstown, and you know what it says, Ken?
says, looking good, looking good, looking K-A-T? Great. No, no, not K-A-T. Looking good, looking great. The retail heart of Mid-Ulster. Nice. That's Cookstown,
that's much
hometown
better.
Of Stuart Dallas.
Well, look, hero. Fair play to him. It was phenomenal. But also the kind of thing that is really is going to freak out Pep Guardiola. This is, again, you know, they're playing Dortmund this week. They're better than Dortmund, but Dortmund have the potential. Do they have the potential to do what Stuart Dallas did? I think maybe they do. So at the moment, you can imagine the plan. That's the fiendish scheme that's putting itself together in Pep's fevered brain. Ahead of that one, so another big game. And what's the other one? We do have to mention Brendan Rodgers. You know, obviously we'll be talking to Dion and John maybe about a bit more detail about this, but just to fill you in case you missed it, they had a bit of a disaster at Leicester. Ayoze Perez had a party. James Maddison, Hamza Chowdhury, Wes Morgan, Harvey Barnes. Harvey Barnes is injured anyway, and Wes Morgan hasn't been playing. All went to it. Why? Guys, like, seriously. Apparently Rodgers had basically had a meeting with them, like, not long before, saying, lads, we're in a great position in the league, in the, you know, we're everything is going really well this season. Let's not make a mess of it, lads. Just whatever you do, don't make a mess of it now. Don't throw it away now, lads. There was this type of meeting, and unfortunately some of his best players go to a house party, like, so they got dropped from the game. They lost to West Ham. And this all happened on the day that The Athletic published a fantastic piece with Brendan Rodgers about his, basically his, you know, why am I so successful? Sam Zell's 10 rules guiding Brendan Rodgers through Leicester's run-in in his life outside football. Sam Zell? Sam Zell is this billionaire American who's mainly known for gutting the American newspaper industry. He's a real estate person, but one of the big things that he did, one of the things obviously that attracted a lot of media comment, was buying lots of newspapers and sort of gutting them. You know, like, I mean, I don't know if you remember season 5 of The Wire, but a lot of it seems to be directed at Sam Zell and his ilk. Anyway, he's been an inspirational figure in the life of Brendan Rodgers, who has apparently Sam Zell's 10 rules for success hanging on like a wall hanging behind his chair in his office. And I was like, okay, well, let's have a look. And it's just the most platitudinous bollocks that you've ever seen. Like, it's literally, you know, take risks, or, you know, take challenges, simplify, just do it. Just do it is one of the 10 rules, you know. And it's all about, like, you know, it says Rodgers admits he doesn't switch off from the game after a 12-hour day at the training ground. 12 hours. After a 12-hour day at the training ground. Why is he over 12? He will either spend his evening watching more football or reading leadership books. I would suggest he expands his range of reading. I mean, sometimes you can learn about leadership by reading things which aren't explicitly called things like the rules of effective leadership. But yeah, I mean, just absolutely phenomenal stuff.
It reminds me of the chapter of the Joe Schmidt autobiography that had the Vodafone slogan as its inspirational quote at the start.
Oh my God, yeah. Absolutely. But Rodgers, who has never been afraid to make big decisions, because, like, one of the rules must be, like, make decisions, as his career testifies, and none more so than his decision to leave Celtic, the club he supported as a boy and had incredible success with. But he has adopted a simplistic approach to decisions. If it feels right, it is right.
Jesus. a load of bollocks.
That is not a good approach. That's not a good approach to decisions. I'm sorry. That's just not good. I hope that
will I cut the lawn today, even though it's really murky, crappy day. It doesn't feel right, so I'm not going to do it. I'm comfortable with that decision. I'm happy with the decision. I'm happy with the process that led to the making of this decision. And so I'm going to stay right here, not cutting my lawn.
Yeah, I saw it. There was a tweet I was looking for here. I saw it the other day. Jonathan Ichikawa tweeted, once I've read both of these, I'll be unstoppable. This is obviously taking the piss. Did you see this, Murph?
Sorry. No.
Yeah, I just heard the little breath go. Anyway, the two books he has in his hand are What They Teach You at Harvard Business School, and then the other book is What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School. It's reminded of that somewhat. Okay, but wrap the report on sport.
It's like something you would expect to see in a porno movie. Joe, go down to Temple Bar, you see them coming out of pubs, vomiting, having sex on the side of the street.
Like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
You know, is that the normal we want in this country? You know, we're supposed to be civilised. As far as I can see, this country is getting more barbaric.
Well, I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
What would you see in a porno movie, Mary?
John Bruin and Dion Fanning are on now to talk about a Manchester United manager who has had his critics but is answering them now, Dion. And I'm not talking about the current incumbent, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but about a former United manager in David Moyes. Give it to me here. I had the last remaining Moyes doubter, surely, in the world last week, Jonathan Wilson on the World Service, who refused to accept the incredible job that he's doing. So tell me, what do you make of the West Ham performance yesterday and of the job that Moyes is doing as West Ham manager?
He's doing a great job. I think they're looking like they're in a strong position now to, you know, the Champions League is not beyond them by any means, and it's you have to give them credit with all the provisos and all the stuff we've talked about before about how the season's dynamics may have actually helped West Ham. And I actually don't think you can dispute that, Owen.
Is this the no fans thing?
Yeah.
But surely the fans would be absolutely over the moon.
They would be
on.
Now. I'm talking. We went through this the last time. We don't need to go through it again.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We could end up just having the same conversation over and over.
Whatever. At the start of the season, the absence of fans certainly helped West Ham and. They would be excited if they could let them in. Well, they will be letting them in soon. He will get the acclaim he deserves from them. So it is. What it probably tells you about David Moyes is that there are clubs for him, and West Ham may be a club for him. Manchester United was clearly not a club for him, and you could possibly say the same about Jesse Lingard. You know, but it just demonstrates that given time and given maybe again the opportunity, as he did with Everton, to kind of work below the radar at times, he can get results.
What has he done with West Ham this time around, John, that you think, what has he delivered to them, and what are they doing that people weren't necessarily expecting them to do?
I think with West Ham over the years, what you've always had is those very brief glimpses of a collective spirit. And as Dion mentions, that also includes the fans. Now, with the fans removed from the equation, now that's not to say that the fans would not be happy the way things are going. But I think David Moyes is a good manager of a small squad and getting the best out of certain individuals. Now, the one that I think of is Craig Dawson. Surplus to requirements at both West Brom and Wolves, at Watford, and who is now sort of the reincarnation of Alvin Martin. And you've got Susek in midfield, you've got, I think a few people would have thought that Declan Rice, if I can mention his name on this podcast, would have been better served by going to a bigger club already, but I think in being given such a leadership role by David Moyes, he's matured into a better player. And I don't think there's ever been any doubt that David Moyes can make certain players better. It's just that the clubs that he's been at since Everton have not been right for him. Manchester United, we know all about that. Real Sociedad, there were certain cultural problems there. Sunderland, where is Sunderland now? And, you know, West Ham. And the funny thing is, he was at West Ham before, and yet they didn't take up the option to keep him as manager, which now actually looks like a piece of good fortune for both the club and David Moyes, because I'm not sure if he'd kept them up at the end of that. I think it was the 2017-18 season. We would have seen the same trajectory. But just on the fans, and this maybe shows you a little bit about how hard they are to please. I think it was The Athletic did a survey on, how satisfied are you in your manager? And I think there were 25%, I think around that number, of West Ham fans who were still a bit doubtful about David Moyes.
Well, you know, they came third in 1985-86, John, so maybe those are the West Ham fans who remember that and think fourth isn't good enough for this mighty club. So we'll wait and see.
John, you mentioned his ability to get the best out of players, and citing Craig Dawson as an example. What is going on with Jesse Lingard, do you think? Because obviously we've seen all scenes of statistics that he is like the hottest goal threat in the Premier League. You know, he is outscoring and out-assisting everybody like by an order of magnitude, which is not maybe something too many people were expecting. So why do you think it's suddenly going so well for Lingard at West Ham, and why wasn't he able to show this form for Manchester United?
I think it's fair to say, though it might seem unfair to say it, Jesse Lingard is something of a streak player. When he's hot, he's hot. When he's not, he's definitely not.
So you think he had like a 2-year streak? I mean, I remember when Solskjaer took over, he kind of scored a couple of goals in the first couple of games, and then just nothing after that. And in fairness to Lingard, Solskjaer had mainly just left him out for the last months and months, but you can't imagine he would have been doing that if there'd been any hint that Lingard was capable of this type of performances.
Well, I would say that the arrival of Bruno Fernandes pretty much cut off any route that Jesse Lingard had to the United first team. Now, I think it's well documented that Jesse's had a few issues off the field. He's someone that's accused of not being grown up enough, but actually he's had to actually live a very adult and grown-up life with problems within his family and having to look after his family. So there is that factor, and there is always the idea that players, when they move on from a club, are refreshed. And I think look at the managers that have thought a great deal of him. Alex Ferguson, back when Jesse Lingard was, you know, a very young player, always said, like, you know, he will mature late and that the club should hang on to him until he was 22, 23, which is exactly when he flowered. I remember speaking to Lee Clark, who worked with him at Birmingham. He just said, you know, that this guy was, you know, the sunniest personality on the training ground, and also the hardest working. But I think that sunny personality did take a bit of a dip for reasons outside of football. There are certain players who play their best football when they have that smile on their face. I used this example quite recently. Dwight York was one. I think Lingard is one of those. And I think there's possibly a bit of fortune to the fact that he's playing as well as he is. But I think with Jesse Lingard, if you let him go, and give him freedom, and David Moyes has let him play a little further forward than he might have done for, say, England and Manchester United, suddenly you've got a player there, and you've just got to ride it while it's, you know, while he's in this form.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe we should at this point pause to consider that Jesse Lingard and West Ham in general were vultures feeding on the dead flesh of Leicester. Who I saw, whose manager, Brendan Rodgers, was just a tragedy on a monument after this game, being interviewed, obviously dignified, as he spoke about the wretched behaviour of some of his young stars, defending them, but at the same time making it clear that he was unhappy with what they had done. James Maddison, guys like this, maybe Lingard's going to end up going to the Euros because, you know, guys like Maddison, who apparently are ahead of him, are blowing up. But what did you make of this thing on? Because, you know, things were looking really, really good for Brendan Rodgers. He was in a similar sort of situation last season with a healthy lead going into the home stretch and ended up fifth. Surely the same thing couldn't happen again.
It could. I think Brendan Rodgers' own career in management would suggest that it's quite probable that might happen, because you know, this is something that has been part of his career at Liverpool, at Celtic and, you know, at Leicester, or, you know,
at Celtic. Well, did you not win everything at Celtic?
Well, I'm talking, when you look at his form in Celtic's form in Europe compared to domestically, and I think that if that was where you could accuse Brendan Rodgers of not making the big the leap. Now, obviously, there are factors at Celtic beyond Brendan Rodgers' control, the decline of the club and, you know, decline of Scottish football, but I think, you know, their form in Europe is something that, under Rodgers, is something that, you know, if you were the manager that, you know, and he has got great strengths, but if you were the manager that his greatest supporters, including maybe Brendan Rodgers, say that he is, you would maybe expect that narrative to have changed a bit. And I would be a bit concerned. You know, like, there was nothing, like, the situation, having the players out who Leicester had out yesterday was clearly a big blow to not have Maddison in the team. Isn't good, you know, was a huge loss for that game, and so you could have sympathy for him in that regard. But I did read that piece in the Athletic where he talked about how he managed to turn last year's negative into a positive, not quite Alan Partridge style, needing two positives, just turning it, you know, just one, he turned it into a positive. So he didn't quite explain in the piece how he actually did turn it into a positive.
He
just
took them to the nice hotel. He
and told them it was a
Grove
positive.
Hotel, wine them and dine them.
And told them it was a positive. He didn't show not tell, I would have said, if I was, being very critical. He just seemed to tell them it was a positive.
And how much do you know about neuro-linguistic programming?
I haven't completed as many, I have any programs in it as Brendan Rodgers has. Clearly, look, the thing about Brendan Rodgers is, you know, people who, there is the argument always kind of rages with him, like, because people say, oh, he gets too much criticism for the stuff he says, and you have to look at what he does on the, you know, with his teams, and they're excited, good to watch, and he gets a lot out of players.
Yeah, all which are good points.
All are great, and all is true, but it reminds me a little bit about, you know, the debate about when Brexit is kind of raging, or especially when it was really raging, and you'd have things happening in Britain and appearing in the British media, and, you know, someone in the EU would point out, like, you know, we can read your newspapers, we can see your newspapers. I feel the same about Brendan Rodgers and his players, because, you know, if players couldn't read or players couldn't hear their interviews, then this would have no impact on them. But it does, like, it doesn't, this self-aggrandizing stuff, or the stuff that seems to materialize at maybe through nothing to do with Brendan Rodgers, that seems to materialize around the time that Brendan Rodgers is being successful or threatening to be successful. Clearly,
what do
the
you
players
mean?
Are aware of it.
What are you referring to? The stuff that seems to appear around the time that Brendan Rodgers is successful.
Well, you know, that Athletic piece, the piece that appeared in the Athletic about this weekend, going back to
10 rules for success.
10 rules for success.
But have there been other examples?
Well, the most famous example, of course, would be in March 2015, when Liverpool were just about to play Manchester United, and a couple of pieces appeared in newspapers detailing how Brendan Rodgers had saved Liverpool's season by going to a formation which he had considered doing previously, but just took his time thinking about it. Spent late nights, 3 a.m. tea and toast, moving salt and pepper pots around, and planning it out. And he settled on this 3-4-3 formation, which was going to, and again, that was also that piece, great insights into you know, the way Brendan Rodgers gets the best out of players, drawing the crown, talking how, you know, Mario Balotelli, he drew the crown, for him to say you were the king of your own. Was it the king of your own destiny? Was that what he? That kind of stuff. And of course, then these pieces appeared that weekend, and then Liverpool went out and lost to Manchester United, and the season really wasn't the same after that. So it does. There does seem to be this. Maybe it's just the nature of, you know, it is the nature of the media too. It is the nature of a manager who is probably more interesting to write about and to discuss than lots of other managers.
Because he's friendly and he talks.
Yeah.
You know, to journalists. I mean, compared to, say, you know, Nuno Espirito Santo, who seems very friendly, would probably be nice to talk to at a barbecue, but like refuses to say anything to journalists, or like other managers who are just, you know, outright obnoxious. Brendan Rodgers is a nice guy. He's probably quite disarming, you know.
Yeah, he is, and he's and that's why I always just, part of me that always wonders is this, when you know, the lessons that Brendan Rodgers is learning, and he talks, you know, this is something that you hear about how he has evolved a lot from his time at Liverpool, from those periods when he probably did speak too much, and, you know, the Being Liverpool documentary was something he took a long time to recover from. But I still think that there is there's still a bit to go in that process, in that sense of, okay, like, even, you know, it's very good, and maybe he's making the best out of every situation, but I was struck yesterday when he's talking about the Leicester players being left out of the squad, and he talked about how they had no option because he believes in values and instilling values, and, you know, you can't get away with these things. Now, the players broke COVID regulations. There's no way, maybe he's making it sound like a more positive thing. There's no way they could have played. Like, if they'd played, and then it turned out that they'd been at a party the week before.
It's true, actually. He was kind of making it out as though he was...
I've taken a stand here.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, I've taken a stand in this pandemic. Other people are letting people go to parties and you know, they just come out and play. If anything else had happened yesterday, there would have been huge uproar. There would have been... So they didn't... Leicester didn't do anything that any other club wouldn't have done. And then you listen to Brendan Rodgers talking about how this is because of his there's something, you know, that he is trying to mold these people into be something other than just footballers for him. He is trying to, you know, it's about values. It's about the club having values. You know, he talks about coming in and that values are something that's important. And that's fine. I would, if I was a cynical Leicester player, I'd be thinking, you know, we won the league 5 years ago. We don't necessarily need to hear about the values from Brendan Rodgers. Like, they had enough values, or certain players in the club had enough values to win the league, you know, in 2016. So they have done something. But yeah, it just struck me again as somebody inserting themselves into a story at a certain point when there is no need for them to insert themselves.
John, we now have David Moyes answering his critics, except for 25% of West Ham fans. We've got Brendan Rodgers answering some of his critics.
Answering questions from journalists.
So what exactly is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer answering, and how good a job is he doing at the moment? Because we have had quite a few people getting in touch saying it is time for, it's time for everybody to give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer his due at this stage. Are you giving that to him?
Yeah, I would give him his due, yes. With caveats, why did Manchester United only play well after going up behind? And I suppose the other issue is that second place looks to be United's destiny for the season, but they are way off Manchester City and have never looked remotely like putting in a title challenge. And
got closer after the weekend, though, John. Man City, maybe a couple of signs of wobbles there, you know.
Yeah, but it was something of a City reserve team, if such a thing exists. And of course, Pep had to. I suspect that there was something of deference to the great god Bielsa there. If Pep likes losing a game, it would be to Marcelo Bielsa. I'm not saying he chucked the game. I'm saying he would be happy enough, you know, that, wow, guys, I got beaten by the best, that type of thing. But Ollie, yes, well, he has answered his critics, and I don't think anyone could say that he has done a bad job with Manchester United this season. And the point at which, well, just, I suppose, just about pre-pandemic, when everyone thought that it was over for Ollie and this great mistake that Ed Woodward had made in appointing him full-time, he's delivered for them in the sense that they will be returning to the Champions League, which is what the Glazer family want. There are glimpses of good football being played, which is what the fans want. And I mean, for a couple of, I mean, the goal that Cavani scored, and then the goal that was disallowed, that was liquid football in the Manchester United tradition. There is something of Manchester United being better than they were under the previous manager. And yet, I personally would have doubts that Ollie is the man to deliver the great successes of the type of dynasty that Manchester United fans really want.
But why? If it's been steady improvement, you know, if they're getting closer, you know, he's gone from wherever they were when he started. They got into the Champions League and last season, and now they're going to finish second. Why do you have doubts? Like, what, the direction of travel seems to be positive now.
Yeah, it is positive, but the manager he beat yesterday, Jose Mourinho, finished second for Manchester United, and I don't, apart from him saying that it was the greatest achievement of his career to finish second, no one else believed that, and he was already on a sticky wicket by the end of that season. I think. Ollie talked the other week, didn't he, about how winning trophies didn't matter, which was an absolutely...
It's an ego thing for some managers.
Which is an absolutely insane thing to say for someone who played for Alex Ferguson. It really is. I'm not really sure what avenue he was barrelling down there. But it's that semi-final record. It's that...
Well, I think, John, just on that exact question, it seems to me as though he was quite deliberately trying to annoy Jose Mourinho, and it seems to me that's something Ole Gunnar Solskjaer does very well. Like,
yes.
I almost can't remember seeing Mourinho this angry with another manager. You know, I mean, okay, I mean, that's ridiculous because he's such a, you know, the type of personality he is. He's always blowing up at people, but something about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer really triggers him. I don't know if it's just that Solskjaer is going to match his career greatest achievement a couple of weeks of finishing second in the league with Man United, but like you saw him after the game yesterday, he was really annoyed. He was really annoyed with that. The stuff he says, like he said, the trophy thing. He's like, well, I think his big boss Ferguson would have taken a different view. You know, this was a comment on that, and then. Just the one, yeah. Well, I think Son is very happy that his father is a better person than Ollie, which just was kind of like, well, you seem angry.
Well, Jose's never really dealt that well with people that have succeeded him at clubs. Him and Rafa Benitez, who never got on well anyway, relationship seemed to curdle yet more when Rafa followed him at... Inter and then Chelsea at a slightly different timescale there. That whole debate over the son and not feeding him, what I can't get a handle on, and I'm told actually that Ollie has used this example before, was he using the word son as a pun on the Korean...
On son, yeah. Son's name. It occurred to me later.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, it would...
That's just a coincidence, is it? Okay.
I don't know. Maybe I'm not giving Solskjaer enough credit here. It just seems like I don't... If he was using it as a pun, why? Why would you do that? Like, he just seemed to be like, if my son did that, and then...
I think his son's about 25, though. That's the thing. So...
Noah Solskjaer, apparently.
Yes, great name. Yeah, I don't really, that whole thing. I mean, as you said, you know, Jose. Why did Jose Mourinho get so annoyed about that? And I think it is to do with the fact that it is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And I don't actually think that Ollie was completely wrong to say that some did make quite a lot of that McTominay handoff. Though I reached back into history and thought of an incident that it reminded me of that was slightly different. Remember when Sol Campbell did that handoff on Ollie in a game at Highbury? It was a 2-2 draw, 2003.
Van Nistelrooy scored a couple of goals.
Yeah, Giggs scored an equaliser. You know, one of the great Premier League showdowns of that United-Arsenal rivalry. And Ollie took a hand to the face from Sol, went down.
Over by the touchline.
Yeah, yeah. Sol was sent off. Sol pleaded his ignorance for many years. In fact, I do recall, in fact, that he released a DVD in which he pleaded his innocence over this. I was watching, as I often do, Gary Neville's Soccer Box, in which that game was shown, and Thierry Henry was in no doubt that Sol should have gone. But I think Ollie went down heavily in that incident in a manner not dissimilar to the way that Son went down. Little did we know that however many years on, we would have this whole metaphor being stretched and it causing one of the great post-match rows.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly one of the weird post-match rows, Dion, like just in terms of the strangeness of what Solskjaer said and the fact that Mourinho then ended up coming out looking worse somehow after Solskjaer had gone on this, like, honestly think, really bizarre sort of tangent about like how he wouldn't have...
I think it was one of those ones where he actually he kind of floated it, and then it's like, okay, I gotta persist with this metaphor.
How do I end this sentence?
And my son now is starving for days because
where do you stand on the fundamental question about Solskjaer? Because, you know, again, I think you are one of those, like myself, like many, who doubted Solskjaer's capacities. I mean, when you see him talking after the game yesterday, I still doubt him. And yet, there he is, second of the league, clear, you know, again, not that close to City at the moment, but clear of all these other teams, many of whom have vaunted managers, and going in the right direction.
Yeah, I my fundamental position on Solskjaer doesn't really change. No matter what he does, because if there was something beyond your expectation of what Manchester United could do, then maybe it would be revised. But I think in some ways it's a similar situation to Brendan Rodgers, in that there is also an element of a manager, you know, a plausibility factor that means that Solskjaer, and I think this holds true for Manchester United fans as well, no matter how insistent they are right now that they have got a fantastic manager, I think there is still that driven really by really a hope rather than a real belief or faith in Solskjaer, and that comes down to that. Again, that sense that a manager that really makes a difference, you get a sense of where they are going, where he wants to get them to, and you can chart that progression through their time. Whereas the argument again that you say he's looking for his best team. He's got players. He doesn't. You know, players are coming in different directions. They're being brought in. He's got to accommodate players, and maybe he doesn't like whatever. But I don't think you ever get that sense that he is working to a huge plan beyond the kind of stuff that occasionally comes out about, you know, we're going to rely on youth and we're going to get bring in young players. And again, that doesn't, you know, there's elements of that. But then Cavani comes in, and Cavani was excellent yesterday. But it's it doesn't necessarily go with that plan. But I think ultimately, you don't get a sense of a manager who is Guardiola, Klopp style manager, who Pochettino, who really feels from the moment he arrives that this is what I am aiming for. And every time we play over a number of years,
you can only have thrown in the Pochettino thing just as a to wind up Manchester United fans, who are surely going to be bombarding this this station with angry emails. But one of the things that I noticed, I mean, Pochettino is different from those other managers because he hasn't won anything yet. He actually did win something recently with PSG. They won some kind of cup. But what I mean is, Klopp and Guardiola, great managers, almost universally lauded, have won the biggest prizes, have had the best players in their teams. You know, have that. That's the difference between Klopp and Pochettino. You could say is Van Dijk and Alisson went to Liverpool in 2018, and Tottenham didn't sign anybody. Now Solskjaer already has quite a lot of good players, but there's one player in particular who I wanted to ask you both about to finish up here, who was involved in the game yesterday, playing for Tottenham at centre forward. He is said to want to leave Tottenham now. Unfortunately, he's got a really long contract. I'm speaking about Harry Kane. Do you think, as Roy Keane believes, he is the player that could turn this Manchester United team into a title-winning team? And do you think there's any possibility of that happening? And I'll ask both of you, starting with Dion.
I think he could change Manchester United around. I think, again, if you see what Cavani has done, and you look at what Harry Kane is capable of, he definitely would improve them. Would he make them a title-winning side? Potentially. I still think there'll be problems with Manchester United beyond that. And I just want to one thing I want to say, actually, I think Solskjaer's thing about silverware was okay. I disagree with John on that one, in that I think Manchester United fired Louis van Gaal when he won the FA Cup. So winning silverware, it's right these days, it kind of matters more what silverware you win. And that comes back to the problem. Like, Klopp was getting that for a while at Liverpool. Like, he needs to win something. He didn't need to win like the League Cup. That doesn't make any difference. So I think there is something in that. But I think Kane would improve any team he goes in. And he clearly, like, the situation for Kane now is how does he get out of Tottenham, and how does he just not be part of whatever decline Mourinho was bringing there?
John,
I think if Manchester United signed Harry Kane, it would be almost as if on their third attempt they actually managed to sign Alan Shearer. Because remember, there was those... Because I think that's the type of player that he would be for Manchester United.
Well, he's the closest thing to Alan Shearer in the current...
Yeah. And I think, you know, they tried to get him in 92, they tried again to get him in 96, I think. And then, you know... And now, in 2021, they finally get their man. And he is the... They've never really, I mean, I suppose Van Nistelrooy or whatever, they've never really had that type of striker. And the problem is, the Harry Kane that I think would fit best into Manchester United is the Harry Kane of 3 or 4 years ago.
So you think that he's... you're not impressed by these outrageous numbers of this season, which suggests maybe he's back to something like his best... You think, no, Harry Kane's had it. It's time to move on to the next target.
No, I don't. I mean, listen, I think he would score goals for Manchester United. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I actually have been pretty impressed by his reinvention. I did think that he would, because of those injuries that he pretty much derailed the previous three seasons, he would have to remodel his game, and he has done that. I think we can talk about Harry Kane at Manchester United. It's some sort of fantasy scenario, because you've got this Daniel Levy factor who some people, well, many people think is some kind of transfer genius, but I think is the master at cutting his nose off to spite his face. And, you know, there's been a few deals have gone down because of Daniel Levy's activities and, you know, the farrago they had over Gareth Bale all those years ago where they basically sold the guy late and then panic bought their way out of it, and then Pochettino had to dredge a team out of the ruins of that, really. I don't know. I imagine that Manchester United's execs will be pretty loath to get into some kind of bidding war with Daniel Levy, and you would also say that Harry Kane's representatives are probably dreading that as well, because extracting Kane from Spurs is going to be quite a long and dirty business, I would predict.
Okay, Dan, I was about to say Daniel, thanks very much. John, thank you very much for the insight on Daniel Levy and the brilliant stuff. Thanks a million.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers. For fuck's sake.
We need to get back to facts here, because there seems to be a bit of emotion creeping in. What you've just said really isn't true.
Well, no. No, what I said... I'm not saying...
I don't know what you're saying, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean, all I
make this
if
point...
You've
got, if you've found someone
on
the street...
Am I interviewing you, or are you interviewing me? He's a goat, he's a god, he's
a man, he's a guru. You cheeky bastard. You're one microscopic cog in his catastrophic
plan, designed and directed by his red right hand.
Let me finish.
What happened to Chelsea?
For fuck's sake.
Well, this is going splendidly, everybody.
Put the cameras up if you want, let's have a chat. Everybody would think that the appointment of Jose Mourinho would have been a great appointment for Manchester United to win trophies. That they would win trophies under Jose Mourinho.
Well, I don't think everybody would have thought that, but I think somebody who didn't know a lot about football would have thought that.
What, the Manchester United? Jose Mourinho?
Yeah.
You cheeky bastard. For fuck's sake. You cheeky bastard. For fuck's sake. You cheeky bastard. For fuck's sake.
I must say I enjoy hearing about Brendan Rodgers, Ken. Have you got any more Brendan Rodgers content for me?
Incredibly, Owen, I do.
Yes.
And somebody sent this to us a few days ago, and I'm sorry, but I can't remember now who it was, but thank you for sending it. And I swear to God, Owen, I couldn't believe this was real, but I think it is real. It's on the Daily Record, like the actual Daily Record website, and it is the Daily Record. It's not like some sort of spoof Scottish tabloid website, right? This is actually the Daily Record website, and I don't think they just publish comedy stories like in that are dressed up to look like news stories. So me, Brendan Rodgers gave John Terry a handwritten Chelsea poem to inspire him after brutally honest intervention. The Irishman helped the centre back out of a form slump with some unusual tactics by Gabriel McKay. Leicester boss Brendan Rodgers reveals he once gave John Terry a poem to bring him out of a funk at Chelsea. Former Celtic manager worked under Jose Mourinho at Stamford Bridge before embarking on his own managerial career. He enjoyed his success, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Terry has described the Irishman as a tough
just
coach.
Just get to the poem.
The Foxes boss went to extraordinary lengths to fire up the centre-back. Rodgers explained on the Robbie Fowler podcast, Jose had left, Avram Grant was the manager, and I felt like there was a group of senior players, in particular John, that were carrying a lot. There's a big burden on him, and John, the skipper that he was obviously trying to help everyone. I could see it was affecting him. He was world class, and he was a good man. I just told him one morning, after training, can we have a word? Because this was a guy who was trying to motivate everyone else. And I was saying over the previous few weeks, how can I help them? So what I did was, I pulled him into one of the rooms, and I was pretty clear with him. I said, listen, for me, you've got to look after yourself, because your performance has dropped. And I didn't want to wait 6 months to tell him something I could tell him now. I was honest with him. I was clear with him. But at the same time, I also wanted to help him. What I did was, I got this montage of clips for him to show him at his best. And then I got a friend of mine who was a writer. And I got him to put together a little story about John and how good he was and how good he could be.
Hand me the guitar.
The writer was much more clever with words than me. So he could fit it into a nice little poem. Then I got that in a frame, and having been around John's house, I knew the colour scheme, and I just gave that to him as a memento to say, you're a top player, and the other boys will look after themselves, we'll look after them, you just make sure you're right. If you're right, everything else goes from there. I think it was just one for me where I could say, who motivates the motivator? He was the club captain. He was the iconic figure. And for me, he needed help. I wanted to help in an emotional way. That's what it's about.
Oh.
So that's...
I really thought we were going to hear the poem, though.
Oh, well, I don't know if
that is.
I just remember the poem. But I saw that and I thought, is this real? But I think it is real. And the Robbie Fowler podcast. So maybe I'll go and... Go and check that out.
I'll tell you what, as part of our 2000 podcast celebrations, if anybody can, well, Ken might find himself, but if anyone else wants to make up what that poem might have been and send it in for a special Owen's Poems, no rules apply. All Owen's Poems rules out the window in terms of rhyming, of coupling, anything like that. Just whatever you think might have been written down in that poem. You can email it in to secondcaptains.com. Champions League during the week. We've got coverage of that. We're also going to be... talking to Roddy Collins. We're going to have tomorrow's Rachel Blackmore show. There's so much going on for World Service members. If you're not already signed up, you can do it on secondcaptains.com. We'll have another short podcast for everyone later on today. Thanks, guys. Sorry for being a bit of a misery guts earlier.
Not at all, Owen. Happy birthday. Great to share this birthday with you. Again.
Oh, no, I feel good. I'm feeling good.
So many.
I feel better just for having heard your voice today.
I mean, there are bigger things.
A day
in life.
That I don't hear your voice is a bad, sad day.
There are bigger things in life than me getting deeper into my 40s without being able to properly celebrate my birthday. So I'll keep that in mind next time. I should probably get stuck into this cake now as well. It looks rather delicious, all told. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, all. Thanks,
Ken. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
It's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.